From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Two years ago today, Chief Masoud Abiola won the Nigerian elections. His prize? Prison. We speak with his daughter, as well as the brother of slain Nigerian activist, Ken Sarawiwa.
Ken preached peace, nonviolence, at every time. We were in a situation in Ogoni whereby Ken had been arrested for every sort of reason by the Nigerian military, you know, backed by Shell, but there was nothing they could get at him. There was only one thing they can use. That is violence. And we
also, new clean air regulations. Big business opposes them. The White House is silent. We look at what's at stake. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Jurors will soon begin deciding whether to condemn Timothy McVeigh to death. Closing arguments are set for today in the penalty phase of the Oklahoma City bombing trial. Then, after U.S. District Court Judge Robert Maich gives final instructions to the jury, deliberations will begin. The jury will be considering whether there are mitigating factors that should keep McVeigh alive. A finding for the death penalty must be unanimous, or the sentence will be life in prison without parole. One person jurors never heard from is Timothy McVeigh, but his parents took the stand yesterday to make a plea for their son's life. Displaying home videos in the court, McVeigh's father, Bill, explained the childhood and early adulthood of his son, just like a father would describe his love for his son. Last week, prosecutors presented testimony from relatives of the bombing victims and survivors whose lives were torn apart by the blast. Today, 2 days before Flag Day, the House will vote on a proposed constitutional amendment banning flag burning. This will be the third time Congress has tried to pass a flag amendment since 1989. That year, the Supreme Court overturned flag desecration laws in 48 states, saying they infringed on free speech rights. Supporters of the amendment say the flag deserves special protection because it's more than a piece of cloth. Critics argue that Americans' freedom of speech would be sacrificed if flag burning is outlawed. The New York Times reports an American music history professor has found two little-known operas in Germany, and he says they were written by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. The discovery was made by David Buch of the University of Northern Iowa in archives in Hamburg. More money would soon be flowing to disaster victims now that Republican leaders have agreed to a compromise. Negotiators are putting final touches on a deal that removes controversial GOP riders to the disaster relief bill. Both House and Senate leaders are looking for quick action today on the revised legislation. Gary Webb, the investigative reporter who linked the CIA to crack cocaine sales in the United States, says he was told he'll lose his job unless he stops working on the series. Webb of the San Jose Mercury News said yesterday that newspaper management pulled him off the Dark Alliance series published last summer. He also said the newspaper is transferring him from the state capital to the small suburban bureau 150 miles away. This is just harassment, Webb says. He went on to say this isn't the first time that a reporter went after the CIA and lost his job over it. Executive editor Jerry Seppos declined to comment, describing the issue as a personal matter. Representatives from the San Jose Newspaper Guild met with management to protest Webb's transfer. Webb said he was pessimistic about persuading the Mercury News to continue to support the series. Webb's series charged a San Francisco Bay Area drug ring, sold cocaine in South Central Los Angeles in the 1980s, then funneled profits to CIA-backed Nicaraguan Contra rebels for the better part of a decade. The French abortion pill RU486 may not be available in the United States until next year. It was supposed to be here by the end of 1997. The New York-based Population Council, which holds the U.S. rights to distribute the drug, says the Hungarian firm that was supposed to make it is balking at its commitment. While the pill has been sold for several years in Europe, many U.S. drug companies are refusing to produce it after being threatened with a boycott by anti-abortion activists. And Betty Shabazz remains in extremely critical condition after her fifth round of surgery to replace her burned skin. Jacoby Medical Center physicians hope the latest surgery yesterday would remove the remaining burned skin from the 61-year-old widow of Malcolm X. Shabazz suffered third-degree burns over 80% of her body in a June 1st blaze at her Yonkers, New York apartment. In international news, in a clash over land near a Jewish settlement, hundreds of Palestinians hurled stones today at Israeli troops who responded with tear gas and live bullets. A 72-year-old protester was brought in dead to a nearby hospital where doctors said he'd suffered a fatal heart attack. The victim's family said he inhaled tear gas. Two Palestinians were wounded by shrapnel and one by a rubber bullet, according to hospital officials. A dozen more Palestinians were beaten with clubs by Israeli troops, this according to witnesses. In this news from Burma, the Burmese army has forced at least 4,000 villagers to carry food and equipment for soldiers fighting ethnic Karen rebels, this according to an exiled student group in Thailand. Many of the porters are women who've been raped by the soldiers, the All Burma Students Democratic Front said in a statement released in Bangkok. The Burmese army launched an offensive in February aimed at wiping out Karen resistance to the military government in Rangoon. The rebels have lost most of their key bases along the Thai border, and more than 10,000 refugees have fled to Thailand to avoid the conflict. And President Clinton sent letters to House leaders arguing that denying China renewal of its favorable U.S. trade status would hurt Hong Kong badly when it reverts to Beijing's rule. About half of U.S.-China trade flows through Hong Kong, President Clinton says. Meanwhile, the White House released a letter backing renewal from all the former secretaries of state. Just kind of makes you wonder why the U.S. does not allow trade with Cuba. And you're listening to Democracy Now!
Operation, operation, operation. Operation, same old right-wing multinational think tank manipulation of history, geography, and information. Out of shame generals still talking war and licking plates in the cafeteria. Operation Desert Dumbness. Operation Army for Hire. Operation Thieves still giving music awards and patting each other on the backs while stealing and imitating and appropriating. Operation, operation, operation.
You're listening to Jane Cortez and the Fire Spitters, Taking the Blues Back Home is the CD. The piece is called Cultural Operations. Well, today marks the fourth anniversary of the annulment of democratic elections in the West African country of Nigeria. The military regime of Sani Abacha has since ruled the most populous country in Africa with an iron fist, regularly jailing and killing opponents, including imprisoning opposition leader Mashoud Abiola and executing acclaimed author Ken Sarawiwa. As head of the Social Democratic Party, Chief Mashoud Abiola was widely recognized as the winner of Nigeria's June 1993 elections. He was subsequently jailed because of his opposition to the military's annulment of the ballot. As for acclaimed author and environmentalist Ken Sarawiwa, he led massive protests against Shell Oil's ecological devastation in southern Nigeria's Ogoni land. The protests damaged the company's reputation and even caused a partial shutdown of some of its facilities. Ken Sarawiwa and eight other Ogoni activists were executed by the military regime in 1995. Today, we're pleased to be joined by Dr. Owen Zwiwa, the brother of Ken Sarawiwa, and a member of the steering committee of MOSAP. That's the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, it's very good to be with you on this day, though the day is not a one to remember it in terms of democratic victories. Can you explain what happened today 4 years ago in Nigeria?
June 12, 1993, Nigerian people went to the polls to elect a democratic leader. And after the votes were counted, Chief Moshood Abiola had most of the votes and was supposed to be made the president of Nigeria. But on the 27th of June the same year, the military canceled the elections and he was not given his due. In 1994, Moshood Abiola was expected and was fighting, you know, to take his mandate, but the military arrested him and put him in detention. Abacha has put him in detention since that time, and he has not been allowed access to adequate medical attention or adequate representation by the lawyers. We want his freedom, and we also want genuine democracy in Nigeria to be restored.
What happened to your brother, Ken Sarawiwa, just 2 years after the elections were annulled? Talk about what Ken did in Ogoni land and what eventually led to his arrest.
Well, my brother represented the voice of the Ogoni people in a bid to protect our environment and also in a bid, you know, to say that democracy comes to Nigeria and all ethnic or communities are represented at all levels of government. And what he's been saying against the activities of the oil company Shell, who is seen as being the major backer of General Abacha, did not go down well with the company.
We say that again. What was he saying? The major backer?
Yeah, the major supporter of the military dictatorship did not go down well with them. And with that, he was arrested on the 21st of May, 1995, 1994. And executed November 10, 1995. Four of our chiefs were killed, and it was framed, you know, as that he incited people to do that.
We're talking to Dr. Owens Wiwa. Dr. Owens Wiwa is the brother of Ken Sarawiwa, who was executed on November 10th of 1995. And since that time, actually 2 days after Ken was killed, Owens Wiwa left the country and felt he could not go back. We'll talk about that in a minute. But I realize for people who are not so familiar with the most populous country in Africa, Nigeria, I'm sure they don't even know what Ogoni land is. Can you place it in geographical context and then talk about the population there?
Well, Ogoni is in the Niger Delta of Nigeria, and it is a small place, a small community, just 12 miles by 32 miles. And it is populated by 500,000 indigenous Ogoni people. And in Ogoni, there are a lot of oil wells, and a lot of oil has been drilled by Shell. And the effect of that has been that a lot of people have been very sick because of the pollution that goes with the substandard method being used to drill the oil. Also, wide areas of land has been laid bare due to the pollution, and also the air has been poisoned and the waterways. Even though about 900 million barrels of oil has been taken out of the place, the people live in poverty. There is no electricity or piped water, no schools, and no adequate medical facilities. The Ogoni people have been poorer because of the presence of the oil company, Shell. And Ken, with other leaders of Ogoni, we mobilized ourselves in such a way that 300,000 people came out to the street to march peacefully against the environmental injustice that has been done by the company.
300,000 people marched. How many Ogoni are there?
500,000.
So more than half of the population.
Plus almost everybody.
A great threat to Shell.
Yes.
Let's talk now about Shell's involvement or lack of involvement in the execution of the author and activist Ken Sarawiwa, your brother. Andrew Rowell wrote some very good pieces in the Village Voice newspaper that didn't get the attention they were due. Andrew Rowell is a British journalist talking about Shell's involvement in his execution, in the sentencing of Ken Sarawiwa to death. The military tribunal, who were the people on that tribunal that decided the fate of Ken and the eight other minority rights activists?
Well, three people were appointed by the military on the tribunal. One military officer, Colonel Ali, and then two civilian judges. But it was under a decree, decree number two, you know, which was done by the military specifically to take care of people who were protesting the presence of the military and their dictatorship.
Now, what did Shell have to do with this?
Quite a lot. Shell's influence in the country is quite much. They produce about 50% of our foreign exchange earning, and with that, they have a lot of power. Apart from that, in the courtroom, in the tribunal room, there was another military officer, Major Paul Okontimo, who has said that he's been on the payroll of Shell. And Shell has also accepted that they did pay a unit he commanded that did a lot of atrocities in Ogoni. He was there talking to the prosecution witnesses, also to the prosecutors and also the judges and all that. His presence was known all over the place. It was as if he was the chief of the court. And whatever he says is what followed. We saw this, and we also noticed the presence of Shell's lawyer in the court. So when we were going around trying to say the truth and appealing to people in Nigeria to say that justice is done and that tribunal is not going to be fair, I was advised to go and speak to the head of Shell, Nigeria, Mr. Brent Anderson. And I went to see him thanks to the help of the British High Commissioner who arranged a meeting for me. And in the meeting, I asked him to use his influence to stop the tribunal and to see that my brother and others who are innocent are free so that discussions and dialogue can continue. He said it would be difficult, but not impossible, but he requested that we show goodwill. So I asked him what was the goodwill, and he said we should write a press release saying that there was no environmental devastation in Ogoniland, and also to call up the international protest that had been going on to free Ken and the others.
So the head of Shell in Nigeria, this Brent Anderson, was telling you that if you wanted to see your brother alive, that you should call off the international protest.
Yes.
What did you tell him?
Well, I didn't have the power to do that, and I told him that, but I will write to Ken and the others, which I did. And I wrote to Ken, and Ken replied back to him that he cannot do that. After that, I requested other meetings with him, but they wouldn't meet with me again.
Did you say to him in the meeting, if you're saying if we call off the international protest, then we can see about preventing the death of Ken Sarawiwa, that means that Shell has control over this? What did he say?
I didn't say exactly that. I mean, I went there with the understanding that Shell knew what was happening and could stop it, and everything that happened there was arranged by them. So I went there with one thing on my mind, that you can do the right thing and let innocent people be free. So when he requested that, and it is true, I didn't have the power to do that. There's no way I could do that. I had to send a message to Ken and the others, and they replied back.
Ken Sarawiwa was executed on November 10th, 1995. I remember the day well because the International Forum on Globalization was holding a huge forum in New York City at the Riverside Church. More than 1,000 people attended. That night, I think Ralph Nader was speaking and Vandana Shiva was speaking, and it was announced there that Ken had been executed.
Well, we were quite devastated. We didn't expect it to go that far, even though we had some rumors that that may happen. We did not know that Abacha would be so callous. And the manner of the execution, despite the pleas of people of conscience all over the world and Nigerians, he still went on to do that. That shows the power of oil in the country.
You were in Nigeria when he was killed on November 10th. You left 2 days later. Why? You've never returned.
Well, after Ken was arrested on the 21st of May, I was declared wanted together with other Ogoni leaders also. So I had to leave. There was a warrant for my arrest, and I had to go. They had to come after me. had to go to continue the struggle.
So you've been speaking about this for the last 2 years around the world?
Yes, together with my colleagues in the Movement for the Survival of Ogoni People and quite a lot of other organizations who are concerned and who want to change to the way transnational corporations are doing business in Africa, because they are really the people who are supporting these dictators, you know, who do all these human rights abuses.
We're talking to Dr. Owens Wiwa, the brother of acclaimed author and activist Ken Sarawiwa. We're going to come back to him in just a minute after our break, and we'll talk about the power of Shell. We'll talk about whether there is an international boycott and the role of the United States government. Is there something that the government can do? But I also, before we go to the break, want to let you know that Democracy Now! Is now online. If you have friends who don't get a chance to hear Democracy Now! Because perhaps we're not broadcast on their public radio station, you can tell them to simply go to our website, which is www.pacifica.org, and they can hear Democracy Now! Today you can tell them they can hear the brother of Ken Sarawiwa, broadcast actually now, though it's not broadcasting. I don't know what you call it when you can hear it on the internet all over the world. We'll be back on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In a minute. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're continuing our conversation with Dr. Owens Wiwa, the brother of Ken Sarawiwa, executed 2 years ago in Nigeria. Today we're talking about Nigeria because it's the fourth anniversary of the democratic elections that were held in Africa's most populous country. It is believed that Chief Masoud Abiola won those elections, but he now sits in a jail cell, imprisoned by the military ruler of Nigeria, Sani Abacha. Owens Wiwa, let's talk a little about the point you left off on, and that is the power of oil. After Ken's execution in 1995, even the U.S. government, you know, spoke out against it and condemned it. But the oil continues flowing. How much oil comes to the United States from Nigeria, and how much does Nigeria rely on its own oil revenues?
Well, the oil revenue from Nigeria represents 98%, you know, of the income we get from exports.
So, and Sani Abacha would not remain in power if the oil spigot had
Sani Abacha would not have the money to buy the weapons of violence to intimidate people if he were not getting money from oil. And he would not have the support that he's getting, which the money is buying, the support, you know, the lobby, you know, that he tends to pay people to lobby for him all over the world. He would not be able to afford that. But most importantly, we noticed that after the execution, just a week after, Shell actually signed a contract with the military dictatorship for a $4.3 billion liquefied natural gas project in Nigeria, even though everybody in the world, most people, were saying what he did is bad and it's not good to give him more money. And that indicated to us, you know, that it's business as usual for companies like Shell in Nigeria. This has been going on for a long time in Africa. European merchants, right from the period of the slave trade, I mean, African leaders to decimate their own people so that they will take captives and sell them as slaves to provide energy for the West. After that, we went through the period of colonialism, whereby European powers still divided people, drew lines in Africa, and gave us names, Liberia, Nigeria, so that resources can still be taken away from Africa at a cheap rate to use and develop the West. Right now is this concept of environmental racism, whereby transnational corporations like Shell go to Africa, support dictators, even import arms, and give to dictators to continue to decimate those who are complaining about the double standards they are using to extract the oil. Because when they destroy our environment, when they destroy our they've been having for us all over the years because of our color, and we want this instant for it to stop. We have caught a company in the act of supporting a dictatorship, in the act of supporting the dehumanization of the people because of the profit they want from the oil. We are not going to let Shell get away with this. We are going to see that they stop, and other companies who are doing the same thing in Africa also stop it.
In this country, in the United States government, what could the U.S. government do? I know that after Ken Saro-Wiwa was killed, there were some low-level sanctions that were put in place against Nigeria. What was it, the cutting of the sale of weapons?
Yeah, there was a ban on the sale of military to the Nigerian army, and also a visa ban on officials of the military dictatorship. We think that they can do more. The oil is the key. That is, the oil could be our freedom, but for now, it is what is locking us. And we want Americans and the American government to stop bringing that oil into this country. 45% of the oil from Nigeria is imported by this country alone. That's a significant percentage.
What prevented President Clinton and the Congress from imposing an oil embargo against Nigeria? What has prevented this until this point?
Well, I wouldn't know exactly. I'm new in this society, but from what I can see, there is quite a big lobby by the business, you know, in Washington, who are saying that that is not good, that constructive engagement is the way to go. We've had this a long time, even from the period of South Africa. We do know that in a nonviolent struggle such as ours, the issue of boycotts and isolating dictators is very important. We are very happy, though, that on June 4th this year, that Donald Payne has introduced a bill.
This is the New Jersey Congress member, Donald
yes,
Payne.
Has just introduced the bill for sanctions on Nigeria in the House of Representatives in the United States. That is a positive step. And
would these include sanctions against importing oil?
I haven't read the whole, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. I hope so, but it doesn't look so.
Now, June 4th is a significant date because wasn't it June 4th that Kudirat al-Abiola, the wife of Chief Abiola, was gunned down in the streets?
Yes, it is about the same time that she was killed by people who are believed to be agents of the military dictatorship on the streets in Lagos. She was a very effective campaigner for the freedom of her husband and also for democracy in Nigeria. And she used to be looked upon by the women in Nigeria as a symbol of women talking about freedom and democracy.
I said earlier, actually, in the billboard of today's show that we would be joined by Hafsat Abiola, who is the daughter of Kudirat Abiola and Chief Mashood Abiola. Unfortunately, she doesn't seem to have made it to our Washington studios. We're broadcasting from New York right now. If she does come in, we'll certainly have her join us. If not, we'll have her join us in another day. I know this weekend both of you, Dr. Owens-Wiwa and Hafsat Abiola, will be very busy because today there's a protest in front of the Nigerian embassy in Washington, D.C., and over the weekend there's going to be a big event in St. Louis as well on this anniversary of the elections that took place in Nigeria 4 years ago but were never allowed to be manifest and actually a new president of Nigeria.
Yeah, people in Nigeria also will also be showing their concern for the continued detention of Mashood Abiola, and there will also be activities in Nigeria and also in London and in other places.
What about a boycott of Shell? Do you support that?
Oh, that is essential. Of course I support it. Without that, democratic Nigeria will not see it in a lifetime. It is so important that we break the alliance between the dictatorship and this particular transnational corporation. As long as Shell continues to support General Abacha, democracy and the rule of law, we will not see that in Nigeria for some time.
You mentioned the lobby in this country for the Nigerian military dictatorship. Now, just a few weeks ago, there were local so-called elections in Nigeria. Roy Innes, the head of CORE, was there. He came back with the wives of the Ogoni chiefs, the four Ogoni chiefs who were killed in Ogoni land. The Nigerian military regime used the killings of these four Ogoni chiefs as an excuse to imprison Ken Saro-Wiwa, saying he was responsible for their deaths. So here Roy Innes brought the wives to this country to talk about Ken Saro-Wiwa, not as a hero, but as a murderer. What's your response?
Well, it is quite unfortunate. As long as the widows of our chiefs have the right to mourn their husband, I can see the position that they are in. I'm in the similar situation. But they know Ken very well, and they know Ken as a man of peace. They have been with him in several instances where he's talking about nonviolence in every forum, both on the video, in his writings, and also publicly. They know him as a man of peace. What they are saying is not the truth, and they know it is not the truth. It is unfortunate for somebody like Roy Innes to be acting, you know, for a dictatorship that is supported by a transnational corporation that has a lot of contempt, you know, for Africans. It is a paradox, because I understand that this association is something for racial equality. What it's doing is not that at all. And for my in-laws to be used in that forum, it's rather a shame. Mm. We would like that they be allowed to mourn their husbands in dignity. But much more importantly, we have to, what is happening? Who is bringing the money that Roy Innes is using to do this propaganda? When we look at where it is coming from, then we'll see what the whole thing represents.
Well, we know that a number of journalists have, particularly black journalists, have been targeted in this country to go on junkets to Nigeria, which has, I think, changed the coverage of Nigeria.
Yeah. There have been quite others who have gone on their own and have said the truth. And there are reports everywhere also. But every African-American should be used today to the divide and rule taxes that is often used by transnational corporations like this, you know, when they want to maintain their hold. It's a pity that it's still going on at this age when everybody should know this sort of game. But the truth is constant, and that is what will keep shining.
Dr. Owens Wiwa is our guest, the brother of Ken Saro-Wiwa, executed in 1995. And I do think now that we're joined by Hafsat Abiola, who is the daughter of Chief Mashood Abiola, who today remains in a jail cell in Nigeria, despite the fact that on this day 4 years ago in Nigeria, he was elected president. And we welcome you, Hafsat, to Democracy Now!
Amy, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great to be with you. I'm sorry we'll just be with you for a short period of time right now, but maybe you can first tell us about what you have heard about your father, who's been in prison for how long now?
He's been in prison since 1994, June. So it's been 3 years.
3 years and, in prison.
Yes. And we hadn't heard anything for the last 14 months. My mother was killed on the 6th of June, 1996. And the last time anyone was allowed to see my father was the January of 1996, before my mother was killed. So for all that time, we'd not heard if he was alive, if he was well, how he was doing. But finally, because of pressure put on by Congressman Rangel of New York, the Nigerian military allowed his doctor to see him, which was about 3 weeks ago. I'm very concerned about the environment that in which the doctor saw my father. It was, first of all, he didn't take any medical equipment with him, so he couldn't do a medical examination. And when he came out of the meeting with my father, which lasted 90 minutes, he was the only one that was allowed to see my father. And when he came out of the meeting, his report was so contradictory. He said my father was hale and hearty, that he's in good spirits, etc. But at the same time, we know that my father's not been allowed to see anyone, not his lawyers, no friends, no family members, no doctors for the past 14 months. Such a person cannot be hale and hearty. And to see, I mean, I think that the doctor must not be speaking the truth of my father's condition, because the last time he was allowed to see my father 14 months ago, and he reported that my father was not well, and was in danger of dying. He was arrested and put in jail for 24 hours, at which time he was threatened. So I believe that the doctor is very concerned about his life and does not want to speak the truth about my father's condition now.
When was the last time you got word from your father?
In May 1996, Owens, do you remember when Minister Farrakhan went to Nigeria?
That was in 1996, quite early, yeah.
Yes, okay, so it was 1996 when the minister went to Nigeria, Minister Farrakhan. He saw my father, and he was actually the last person allowed to see him. And he's a supporter of the military regime. But when he went into Nigeria, he insisted on seeing my father, and my father spoke to him and said he should bring a message to me that we must continue to stand for freedom in Nigeria, that he remains resolute behind his mandate. And the minister said an Islamic prayer with my father because they're both Muslims. And that was the last we heard from my father.
Since I assume you've spoken to Minister Farrakhan for him to convey the message to you, have you asked him why he supports Sani Abacha, the military ruler who has imprisoned your father?
Well, when I spoke to him, he said when he was in Nigeria, he was aware of the human rights devastation in Nigeria, the people were being killed and imprisoned unjustly, that the system of government was corrupt. But he said that we have to be aware of the larger threat of the so-called white man that was trying to destroy Nigeria for their own white imperialist agenda. And it's very interesting that he says this because the only white presence in Nigeria now that is exerting influence is the oil multinational corporations that at this time stand behind the military regime. So if you're concerned about a white agenda, you would not stand with the military but with the people of Nigeria. So I don't understand. He understood that there's some white imperialist agenda and therefore we have to stand with the black government of Nigeria. But we in Nigeria have said that the people in Nigeria speak for democracy. They want to be empowered. And that it is the empowerment of 100 million people in Nigeria that will ensure that we're not vulnerable to external forces that might be hostile to our people or our cultures. But he doesn't seem to understand that.
On June 4th, the legislation was introduced by New Jersey Congressmember Donald Payne. Owens Wiwu was just telling us, what is contained in this legislation?
The legislation is strong. It speaks for democracy in Nigeria, denounces the military, demands increased sanctions. But it is a pity, and I'm sure that from listening to Owens, you understand the tragedy of this. It does not include a motion for sanctions on oil in Nigeria. It has language for sanctions over all other investment, all other financial investment, all other forms of sanctions, including a sports ban on Nigeria while the military is in control. But it does not allow for oil sanctions because although Congressman Donald Payne understands the importance of an oil sanction, he doesn't believe that it will pass in Congress.
I met you, Hafsat, in St. Louis months ago when we both spoke at an Amnesty International training for high school and college students. And we were talking then about Illinois Senator Carol Mosley Braun, who went to Nigeria and spent time with the military dictator and his wife, Sani Abacha and his wife. What are your feelings now about her support of the military regime, and have you gotten a chance to speak with her?
I'm actually looking forward to a chance to speak with not only her, but with the entire Congressional Black Caucus, because they have to lead to push for this sanctions bill so that it will pass in Congress. But I have not had a chance to speak with her as yet. She's only strengthened our support for the military over time. In fact, she's joined now by Congressman William Jefferson of Louisiana, and to show that their support has only increased for the military. As Congressman Donald Payne and Maxine Waters in the Congressional Black Caucus were pushing to introduce this bill on Nigeria into Congress, William Jefferson wrote this 4-page memo to all members of the Congressional Black Caucus denouncing the efforts of Maxine Waters and Donald Payne, demanding that there should be increased support for the Nigerian military, evinced by such actions as sending military officers of the United States government to Nigeria to work as advisors with the military, and other such efforts that just seem so bogus. His whole letter was titled The Need for Constructive And was the theme of his whole letter was the need for constructive engagement with the Nigerian military. This has been shown not to work. So why he would go back to this is beyond me. And in writing that letter, he was working with the support of the Illinois senator. So their support for the military has not in any way been reduced by the pressure of their own constituency on them.
We have to break, but when we come back, we'll finish up this conversation with Hafsat Abiola, the daughter of Chief Mashood Abiola, in prison for 3 years now in Nigeria. We've also been speaking with Owens Wiwa, and I encourage people to get out their pens, because after the break, we're going to get some phone numbers of where their groups can be contacted. Hafsat Abiola with the Kudirat Institute for Nigerian Democracy, and Dr. Owens Wiwa with MOSAP, the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People. You're listening to Pacifica Radio. Democracy Now, and we'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We're just going to wrap up our conversation right now with Hafsat Abiola, the daughter of Chief Mashood Abiola, who sits in a Nigerian prison for the last 3 years, despite the fact that he was elected president 4 years ago today in Nigerian democratic elections that the military ruler, Sani Abacha, annulled within a few weeks. Hafsat Abiola is with us, as is Owens Wiwa, who is the brother of Ken Sara Wiwa, executed by the military regime on November 10th, 1995. Hafsat, you've just begun the Kudirat Institute for Nigerian Democracy. What are you doing here in this country, this institute named for your mother, gunned down just a year ago?
We're trying to build friends for Nigeria and the United States. The U.S., as Owens has explained, is extremely influential financially in Nigeria. It supplies about 45% of the money the military spends every year. And so far, because of the domestic oil lobby in the U.S., the American government will not take consistent steps to support democracy in Nigeria. But we believe that by building friends, people in the U.S. concerned about Nigerian struggle for democracy and for human rights, that we'll be able to get the U.S. government to take steps that are consistent and just. And that is the main work of kind in the U.S.
Do you know who killed your mother?
The General Abacha. The bullet that was used to kill my mother is the same kind that has been used to kill other political leaders in Nigeria that spoke for democracy. It's a special bullet that dissolves on impact with its victim. It's highly poisonous, and it's only available to governments. And my mother's death came after increasing harassment by the military. A letter had been written to her by General Abacha threatening her a month prior to her death and asking that she come and kneel before him as an act of surrender, and that she, should she do that, it will release her husband. She rebuffed him, of course, and because of that, he'd become very incensed. And I think the order to have her assassinated followed shortly after.
Well, I want to get the phone numbers of both your group and Dr. Owens Wiwa. Owens, could you tell us how people can get in touch with MOSAP here in this country, the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People, which you and your brother have been so influential in?
Right now people can phone 202-387-8030.
One more time, a little more slowly, in Washington, D.C.
202-287-8030.
That's 202-387-8030, and that's in Washington, D.C. And Hafsat Abiola, your institute, the Kudirat Institute for Nigerian Democracy,
can be reached at 202-965-5177.
That's 202-965-5177. I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Good luck this weekend on all the events that you're involved with, honoring the Nigerian elections of 4 years ago.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Hafsat, and thank you, Owens Wiwa. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we move now to an issue in this country that you may not have heard about, but is being fought out in Congress, and it's the issue of clean air regulations. Do stay with us.
Water's not digging for roots in the shadows. There's no dying of hunger stare in eyes of Chief Executive Officer of Petroleum. Somebody else is sinking into spring freeze of the soil. Somebody else is evaporating in dry winds of the famine. There's no severe drought in mouth of senior vice president of funding services. No military contractor is sitting in heat of a disappearing lake. No river is drying up in kidneys of a minister of defense. Under Secretary of
You're listening to Jane Cortez and the Fire Spitters. The piece now is Global Inequalities. Well, a new study released yesterday reports that industrial air pollution appears linked to death among infants, including sudden infant death syndrome. Federal researchers from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Environmental Protection Agency found that infants in areas with higher levels of industrial soot were 40% more likely to die from respiratory failure than children who live in areas with cleaner air. The study comes in the wake of a heated debate over proposed new clean air rules by the Environmental Protection Agency. Big business, as well as some in the White House, have balked at the EPA's clean air proposals because they say the environmental controls are too costly. The Clinton administration is expected to decide shortly on the new rules. We're joined by two people right now with two different perspectives on this. Daniel Rosenberg is with us. He is an air quality and drinking water policy advocate and staff attorney with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, which has been leading the campaign for the new clean air rules. And Kay Jones is on the phone with us, an adjunct scholar with the Citizens for a Sound Economy, a group based in Washington, D.C. that promotes market-based solutions to public policy problems, has a lot of industry support. Kay Jones joins us by phone from Seattle, Washington. Daniel Rosenberg, first explain what these regulations are that the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, is trying to institute.
Okay, thank you, Amy. Under the Clean Air Act, there are health standards set for different types of air pollution, including ozone, which is what people commonly know as smog, and particulate matter, which most people know as soot. EPA has proposed to strengthen the health standards, tighten the health standards for both smog and soot, as they are required to do under the Clean Air Act. The EPA is required every 5 years to review the scientific evidence supporting standards, and if they find that the standards are not sufficiently protective of public health, then they are supposed to strengthen the standards. And they've done an exhaustive review of the scientific literature for both of these types of air pollution and found that, in fact, the current standards are not protective of public health.
So what's the problem? Why can't they just institute the new regulations?
Well, they have proposed strengthening the standards, and they are due to finalize their proposal in mid-July. What's happened is, since the proposal was made in November, major industries have launched a massive campaign to block the new standards from going into effect, and they're doing that by lobbying Congress and the Clinton administration heavily and spending millions of dollars both inside and outside the Beltway to get either Congress to block the standards or to get the Clinton administration internally to agree to weaken the standards.
What has the Clinton administration done?
Well, right now the Clinton administration is having what they're calling interagency meetings to discuss the EPA's proposals and try and work out some sort of, to determine whether they're going to issue the standards as proposed by EPA or whether they are essentially going to weaken them. It's similar to what happened really during the Bush administration when the Quail Council was part of the administration. EPA would propose different health or environmental standards, and after they were proposed, business would get sort of a second bite at the apple by having the internal Quail Council try and weaken whatever proposals were made because of cost to large industries.
As I said, we are joined by Kay Jones, who's with Citizens for a Sound Economy in Seattle, Washington. What is your response to these EPA regulations, and are you among those who are pushing to have them weakened?
I'm not pushing to have anything weakened. What I'm pushing for is a rational interpretation of the information. And it's rather interesting that my colleague who's on the air here has misspoke about what the conclusions were. With respect to the smog standard, it was very clear that the advisory committee to EPA said, yes, we need to change the form of the standard, but based on their interpretation of the health effects information, that the new smog standard should be no more stringent than the current standard. In fact, they said that there was no significant health protection benefits among the various alternatives. The other point I want to make is that, and I guess Mr. Robertson has not reviewed my work, but there are only three studies that EPA relied upon, which actually had PM, the fine particle measurements, and there's only three studies that they relied upon, and unfortunately, they made grievous errors in interpreting those studies, and despite all the other problems of lack of relationship between the cause of the health effects that have been noted, it turns out that there's no way that the 15 microgram standard could be defended. So what I'm pointing out here is, had they interpreted the studies properly, they probably would have set the standard at least 20 micrograms or higher. And when you do that, we find that there's practically no exposure in the United States above a level of 20 micrograms per cubic meter.
Dan Rosenberg, what's your response to that?
Well, Mr. Jones is speaking as an adjunct scholar with Citizens for Sound Economy, which I'm not sure how well it's known outside the Beltway. Inside the Beltway, they're widely recognized as essentially an industry front group that gets millions of dollars from oil companies, chemical companies, and auto companies, et cetera, to fight all kinds of environmental and public health regulations on Capitol Hill. Mr. Jones is speaking in code a little bit when he says that there's a lack of a cause and effect relationship, I think is what he's saying. In the studies, that is basically the cigarette industry's argument for why, unless we have exact cause and effect relationship, we should never regulate smoking. The same argument is being now extended to other types of pollution, including air pollution, to suggest that unless we know exactly the biological cause of a type of air pollution, then we should not do anything to regulate it.
Let me respond to that, if you don't mind.
Go ahead, Kay Jones.
All I said was the CASE Act themselves, the advisory committee, has said that is a major problem. It's not me saying that. It's not industry saying that. And what I said was that it's EPA staff error that led to recommending a number that was inconsistent with the available data. And I think this continued issue about whether it's you're just shooting the messenger, because I have received no sponsorship whatsoever for doing this work. I did it on my own simply because with my 40 years of experience, I think it's unfair to politicize and hype the public and not tell them the factual information. And one of my questions I have is that whether or not you have in fact reviewed my reports, which were released 2 weeks ago, and could provide me with a written critique with your signature on it as to what flaws you found in my analysis.
Daniel Rosenberg.
My turn. I have no idea what specific funding Mr. Jones get. I'm talking more broadly about Citizens for a Sound Economy, which is heavily funded, as I said, by different industries, and so they're being put forward so that Shell, Exxon, Ford, General Motors can somewhat recede a little bit in this, which is the latest in a series of historical fights over strengthening air pollution standards under the Clean Air Act. The general arguments are the same that have been made repeatedly over the history of the Clean Air Act, whether the issue was setting an acid rain provision in the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments, phasing out lead and gasoline. All of these arguments that were made at different times are being made again, you know, that the studies aren't sufficient. We don't have enough scientific evidence to justify moving forward, that the cost will be too great, et cetera. The argument about that there is only three studies that support setting a tighter particulate standard is simply wrong. There, EPA reviewed hundreds of studies, both of smog, that looked at smog and soot, and the Clean Air Science Advisory Committee that we're referring to overwhelmingly supported setting a new standard for fine particulates and a new ozone standard.
Excuse me, but that's just, you just have not responded to what I said. The Clean Air Advisory Committee said, yes, we need to change the form of the ozone standard, but it should be no more stringent than the current standard. And if you're forthright and directly reporting it correctly, KSAC said that the advisory committee that yes, we possibly should set a new PM 2.5 standard, but only two members out of 21 recommended the range of the standard between 15 and 20. So let's be forthright what the recommendation was. And once you correct for the error that EPA acknowledged that I brought to their attention, suggest that the standard could not be set despite all the other possible problems, it would have to be set at some level of 18 micrograms or above. And you still haven't responded to me to whether or not you reviewed the reports that I publicly released 2 weeks ago criticizing how EPA interpreted those three standards. I'm not arguing with you about what all the studies are out there. It's how EPA interpreted them.
There's a disagreement over what level of agreement or disagreement KSAC had on these standards. They broadly supported moving forward on PM fine particulate standard and ozone standard. It's correct that there was no consensus on what the exact level of standards should be, and that's EPA's job to decide that. That's
their policy judgment to make. Excuse me. Did KSAC say or did they not say that the new ozone standard should have the same stringency as the current standard? Did they say that or did they not say that?
There was not unanimity amongst the members.
I said the consensus.
I'm going to interrupt here because we're going to have to wrap this up in a minute, and I just want to find out what is happening at this point. People right now in this country, if they want to be involved in this process, where do they turn? Let me ask each of you, and you just have about 30 seconds to respond. Dan Rosenberg?
You're wanting to know what's going on now,
what
the status is?
Right. The EPA has to make a decision, what, in the next how many days?
It's the next week or so is when they will make a decision. There's a process that has to be worked through within the White House. So a decision should be coming out in the next week or so. If people are interested, they should contact the White House and express their interest in strong air pollution controls.
Kay Jones, last response from the Citizens for a Sound Economy.
Well, first of all, I think Mr. Rosenberg's organization should be ashamed of themselves for the ad that they put in the New York Times, and I wish we had more time to take. I think they've got the long nose on the wrong party, and I advocate the fact is we still need 5 years to redo the studies that EPA relied upon, as well as review the study that just came out yesterday.
On that note, I'm going to have to thank you both for joining us. Kay Jones with the Citizens for a Sound Economy, speaking to us from Seattle, Washington, and Daniel Rosenberg, a staff attorney with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, which has been leading the campaign for the new clean air rules. Thank you both very much for being here with us. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And if you'd like to reach us via email, our address is democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. And starting yesterday, you can hear us on the website. You can actually hear Democracy Now! By going to www.pacifica.org, and Democracy Now! Can be heard around the world. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland is our engineer and assistant producer. Andy York is our Washington engineer. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Chairperson of the board is not digging for roots in the shadows. There's no dying of hunger stare in eyes of Chief Executive Officer of Petroleum.